You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Who would want to kill you? That is a question that Officer Marianne Robb asked Brandon when she first arrived. That's a question that Detective Pillar asked Brandon when he spoke with him. Brandon Boudreau gave the exact same answer to both of these officers. He gave them two names. Lori Vallow, the woman seated over here, and Alexander Cox. He told them that he believed his shooting had something to do with an incident that occurred in Chandler in July of 2019, a couple months before this. He pointed them to that. He told them that Lori Vallow had lived in Texas and that the Jeep used in this shooting was from Texas. And then he told them what happened, how he had come home that morning. This Jeep was parked unusually close to his driveway, waiting. That he noticed there was no tire on the back. That he noticed that Texas license plate. That it was a two-door Wrangler. And then he noticed that window go up. He saw the rifle come out. He saw what he believed was a silencer at the end. And then he heard and saw that bullet that hit the frame of his car, shattering the window right near his ear, causing that loud bang that he heard when that struck right near his head, mere inches away from him. Brandon drove off and called 911, actually panting in panic from what he had just experienced. This defendant's co-conspirator also drove off to try to escape, immediately calling this defendant's soon-to-be husband, Chad Daybell, and Googling a way to get back to Idaho Falls, sort of through back roads. The names that Brandon Boudreau gave the police were correct, but Brandon had no idea of the amount of planning that had gone on leading up to this October 2nd shooting. As you've seen and heard in this trial, much of this conspiracy, this planning, this premeditation occurred in Idaho. So what I'd like to do is go through the evidence, discuss it all together in a timeline that might make a little more sense than the presentation during trial. And show you how it all fits together. Show you how all of this evidence points to one conclusion, that this defendant was involved in that conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. Next, I'd like to talk to you about the jury instructions, go through some of them specifically, and then talk to you how this evidence proves beyond a reasonable doubt that this defendant is guilty. And finally, I want to talk to you about, I'll call them so-called defenses. Maybe that there was no shooting at all, perhaps Melanie did it, or maybe just that this defendant wasn't involved. And we'll discuss those options. So let's start with a timeline that you heard from the beginning of this trial starts around June 25th. When Brandon Boudreau learns that this defendant has been feeding lies to his then wife, Melanie. She has been telling Melanie things like Brandon hacked into her computer, that Brandon was gay, that Brandon was trying to take her Temple Recommend away. Brandon told you that he had heard these things from Charles too, this defendant's husband at the time, who had told Brandon that his wife, Lori Vallow, was telling Brandon's wife lies. What did we learn from this? Brandon, in fact, texted Lori about this, told her why are you spreading these lies about me? Why are you destroying my marriage? And as you learned, she didn't respond. Then you heard about that July 11th, 2019 incident in Chandler, Arizona. The one that Brandon, both to Officer Robb and to Detective Pillar, said, this has to do with this incident. What you learned from Detective Duncan, who came here, was that on July 11th, there was an incident. Lori Vallow was there. It was at her house, and Alex Cox was there. In her garage was that 2018 Jeep Wrangler with the Texas plates LWD0997. And you learned that Alex Cox has his own vehicle. He doesn't need to borrow his sister's. He can drive his truck anywhere he wants. As Brandon's divorce is progressing, and he's seeking a mediator and working through that, this defendant and her brother move to Rexburg, Idaho. You are provided with various documents from search warrants, both through Detective Duncan and Lieutenant Hermosillo, through Lolitime iCloud accounts for this defendant, showing that she had emailed Blue Skies, that she rented an apartment up there. We see that she was searching for areas up there. We also saw that her brother, Alex Cox, moved right up there with her. Now, you heard from Brandon that part of their divorce, Melanie moved into her own residence. And they put their community home up for sale. And on September 13th, when their home had sold, but it was still pending, he rented that house at 3875 East Phelps Street. He told just a handful of people that address. Melanie Boudreau asked for it on September 17th, and he provided it to her. Why wouldn't he? The only other people who knew that address were his two neighbors and a couple of friends, five people. But the only one that knew this defendant and Alex Cox, the woman that she referred to as her mom, that was her mom figure, this defendant, Lori Vallow, is the only one that would have known that address so that Alex could go there later. We know that on September 25th, Brandon moved into that residence. And he moved in early because his then soon-to-be ex-wife was leaving out of town. We know in the same time period, Melanie knows the address. The plan is already starting. Alex is searching for places to shoot. He is also looking for tent shops. Not a tent shop for his Ford F-150, because if you lay in the back of the truck, of course all the neighbors can see you. He is going to borrow this defendant, his sister's Jeep, Melanie Boudreau's mom. And so he finds a place that will tint that Jeep as dark as possible, so that even in the daylight, no one can see into the back, so he can lie in wait. We saw that not only does Alex search for and get to Dan's windows, and this is important. You may say, well, who cares? Of course we know that. We heard from Dan Moss. But when you start thinking about the other searches to these Gmail accounts and you want to authenticate them, you know that these are legit. Why? Because here's Alex searching how to get to Dan's, and then what does he do? He shows up there with this defendant's Jeep so that it can be tinted. What do we know? We know again from Dan that they spent $200. They're in Idaho. This Jeep is already tinted. Why would you ever put additional tint on that Jeep? It's not even your primary car. We see Lori Vallow driving her little Nissan Rogue all over the place because you need a vehicle that you can hide in the back of and that you can shoot out that back window from. The burner phone. We heard this morning from Nick Balance, and he talked to you about both the records that you have seen that were admitted, as well as now the Google location data and cell phone analysis. What do we know that on September 25th, when that burner phone was purchased at that Walmart, Alex Cox's phone is there, and Lori Vallow's phone is using a cell tower in that area. They drive out of town to a different Walmart to go buy this phone. Lori Vallow doesn't live in Idaho Falls. She lives in Rexburg, but her phone is in Idaho Falls talking with Melanie Boudreau. What do we know the next day? Alex Cox activates that burner phone. That burner phone is only going to be used for one trip. The trip to Gilbert, Arizona and back. This is what you learned from Nick Balance this morning. That again, Alex Cox's phone tied to that Google account is showing right there in the Walmart. This defendant's phone is also in Idaho Falls, utilizing a tower at that Walmart. Then we know on the 26th, when we're activating this phone, Melanie Boudreau flies up here to be with the defendant. We know at this time, Brandon Boudreau has the kids. And we know that they have an agreement. Brandon will keep them Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. Wednesday, October 2nd, he will hand them back to her and they will stay with her. So when he's shot and killed, it won't matter because she'll have the kids. It'll be fine. They know, because it's the plan, that their youngest gets dropped off every morning. Brandon will pull up to the park and let her know he's there. And so all of this information is known. Now, how do we know it's known? We know by the timing. And so we'll go through that. But remember, this is when Melanie's coming up and spending 3 days with this defendant. She has to be back Monday. Why? Because she's going to take the kids like she always does. Again, we have Alex Cox preparing for this shooting. We know he is not only practicing, but he's trying to figure out trajectory. What do we know? That this is a moving car. Alex Cox is going to have to try to fire out the back of a Jeep at a moving car. And ladies and gentlemen, he came pretty close to being successful at that. We know that Melanie flies back to Arizona. And then we have the beginning of the trip. And the beginning of this defendant starting the giant alibi defense that she does. Why would anyone ever take someone's cell phone and carry it around with them? Why would you take someone's cell phone and do that? Why would you make phone calls between each other other than to ensure that it looks like Alex Cox is still in Idaho? They think he has a burner phone. No one will even know. Great idea, other than we know he hooked it up to his Google account. So we know that the afternoon of the 30th, Alex takes his phone over to his sister's apartment. And it stays there, or with this defendant, until he returns on the 3rd. We know that at about 5:15, Lori Vallow searches how to remove the back seat of the Jeep. Alex Cox still is there, and now she is helping him get ready for his trip. She has his phone. She's giving him her Jeep, and she is helping him make it more comfortable so he can lie in wait in the back. They had to remove the tire, and they had to remove that back seat. We know that sometime that evening, Alex Cox leaves Idaho and moves towards Gilbert. We heard from Detective Piller that there was an LPR reading for that Texas license plate LWD0997 at around 810 outside of Rexburg, Idaho. We know from balance that there is no phone activity until we see the phone arrive in Arizona. We also know that the Jeep is in Arizona. So we have the burner phone and the Jeep and Alex Cox's Googling in Arizona. Holbrook, we see that LPR reader showing the Jeep with no tire on the back so they can open that rear window exactly as Brandon explained, this defendant's Jeep. What do we know is that, again, the burner phone is calling one person, this defendant's husband, Chad Daybell. We see that Alex Cox is in Arizona with other physical evidence. What is that? It's that receipt from Los Favoritos that was recovered inside the Jeep in Idaho. So we know the Jeep is down here. As much as the defendant wants to tell you about colors or whatever else, her Jeep was here in Mesa on October 1st of 2019. We can just stop pretending that didn't happen. We know as well, when we look at those Google records, or we're trying to authenticate them, that the Los Favoritos was on Power Road in Mesa. And after having lunch, Alex Cox Googled another location on Power Road. Now, this defendant, in aiding this conspiracy and helping her brother, starts by renting that storage unit. Now, she rents that on October 1st. She also still is in possession of her brother's phone. So this way it looks like Alex Cox is going with her to the storage unit. She's providing that alibi because they don't think that the burner phone has hooked into this Google account. They don't know about the LPR readers. They don't think about the receipt. So Lori Vallow provides his alibi and she brings the phone with her, and we know that Alex Cox's phone is with this defendant as she's renting a storage unit. Even though we know from the video, he's not there. She's alone. When you watch these videos, and if you want to, they're obviously admitted, you will see one person get in and out of that car. And one person go into the storage unit. That one person is this defendant, Lori Vallow. So even though Alex Cox's phone is here, that's just a ruse. That's her aiding, that's her conspiring, that's her trying to cover up this murder for her brother, who is the shooter. What we know as well is by October 1st, we know the Jeep and Alex Cox are here in Arizona. And we know that that evening of October 1st, he Googles that address. The address that only five people knew. The address that this defendant's niece, the person she said she is like a mom for, that's where her ex-husband, or soon-to-be ex-husband, is living. He Googles 3875 East Phelps Street, even with the zip code into it. And then he gets directions there, getting prepared, knowing where he needs to go the next morning. Why? Because again, Melanie and Brandon have a very set schedule, and they know that Brandon's going to drop off the kids and then meet Melanie to pass off their youngest, and Alex will be waiting at home. We know the next morning, Alex Cox Googles again the address for Brandon's home. We know that that morning, Alex Cox's burner phone is utilizing towers near this defendant's niece, Brandon Boudreau's soon-to-be ex-wife's home, Melanie Boudreau. And we know that the calls that he is having with are with this defendant's husband, Chad Daybell. And we know that by 7:22, Alex is moving towards Brandon's home. He knows that Brandon is going to be leaving to take the kids to school because Melanie knows the schedule. And he will be waiting when the kids are dropped off. The morning of October 2nd, Brandon has a very normal schedule. He's got to get his kids to school. He leaves around 7:25. He drops off his first kids at school, and then he meets with Melanie and drops off their youngest. Melanie does not know that Brandon is going to work out. Normally, he'd go home. Alex would be waiting there. But instead, he went to the gym. Now again, we've heard a lot of questioning of whether or not a Jeep existed there or not, but we all know that it's this defendant's Jeep. But we also know that a neighbor across the street saw the Jeep there, and not only saw it, but knew something was wrong. He told you that it was parked on the wrong side of the road, nose to nose with that white van, that it was running, that it had really dark tint. And in fact, he told you he was so thinking it was out of place that he actually looked in his rearview mirror to try to just see what the license plate was, and he noted it was a Texas license plate. He told you it was just a dark Jeep, whatever color that is. And we know at this time period again, this defendant's burner, or this defendant's co-conspirator's burner phone is still calling one person, and that is Chad Daybell, this defendant's husband. Now, we know that this defendant has been carrying around Alex Cox's phone. The phone subscribed to him. The one that if you looked at, you'd be like, oh, there's where Alex Cox is. Look at that Wi-Fi. She's been carrying it around, and now she knows if at 7:40 there's going to be a handoff of the kids, we need to make the alibi, 8 o'clock. And so at 8:02 Arizona time, she has Alex Cox's phone call her phone, and there's a fake 24-minute call. Look, Alex couldn't have done that. He's up here in Idaho with me. Of course, Brandon was at the gym, so it's a little early. But still, it's an alibi. Can't have run down to Arizona in those next 40 or so minutes. So we know, of course, that while that fake call is going on, the Idaho Falls burner phone is in Gilbert, utilizing cell towers that are in the area of 3875 East Phelps, and Lori Vallow's Jeep is parked right outside of Brandon's house, waiting for him to return home. We know that 20 minutes before Alex Cox shoots at Brandon, Lori Vallow's phone gets a call from Melanie Boudreau. Here they are, still talking and conspiring, trying to figure out what's going on. Where is Brandon? Brandon returns home about 9:13. Alex Cox has been waiting there now for almost 2 hours. He returns home and sees that Jeep. Just like Robert Abitamarco, he notices it being parked really close to his driveway and it stands out to him. And of course, then he sees that window open and that barrel come out and this gun shoot at him and almost hit him. We know from Lynette Mendoza, who had a Ring camera, that just a few seconds before that shooting, her Ring camera had shown a black car, and you just see a bleep of it in the beginning as it kind of jumps, go by that corner. And then a few seconds later, you hear that loud bang. When you look at the time on that Ring camera that you have admitted, it matches up with that 911 call with when Brandon is calling in to say he's just been shot at. Like Brandon said, loud. You've heard a lot about the color of this Jeep. Even when we look at photos of the exact same Jeep here, they all look a little different. You have the DEA one that looks almost silver or brown, I don't know. You have an upper one from Chandler that looks a different gray with a dark gray, and then you have the one from Dan Moss that looks more greeny colored. What do we all know? They all have the same license plate on them. They're all this defendant's Jeep. So when we're talking about color, that's just everyone's perspective. What do we know in actuality? That Brandon's Tesla was shot by a large round, that it hit the corner of that glass that went up into the frame of his vehicle, that it left a divot in the glass, and that somehow the police, in trying to search a giant block radius, were not able to recover those pieces of the projectile. We only have a few fragments of it. But everyone who has worked these scenes knows that's a bullet hole, and those were projectile fragments, and that was a gun that Brandon saw, and that's a shot that he heard. Immediately after missing, hitting Brandon, Alex Cox takes off and is searching for directions out of there. And you saw those and you saw a map as he went east, and those matched with the cell phone and cell tower records that Nick Balance told you about. Brandon is on the phone with 911. Alex Cox is fleeing because he knows Brandon's alive. We know that the other part is that while this is going on, while Alex is searching for his way home and has been talking to Chad Daybell, knowing now that Brandon's alive, what do? They go hide the tire and hide the seat. So the timing of those videos when Chad Daybell, person who is talking to Alex Cox, and this defendant go to the storage unit is as Alex Cox is calling him and telling him whatever as he's fleeing to go home. So we know that they arrive there, and you can watch these. By they, I mean Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow. And we know that they bring in a tire and what looks like a seat. You can actually see Chad rolling the tire in. And again, why is this important? This is this defendant who has helped take the tire and seat out of her Jeep to make it available for her brother to take his guns down to Arizona to shoot at her niece's soon-to-be ex-husband. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about this conspiracy. As time goes on after the shooting, we know that again, that burner phone and that Jeep are returning back to Idaho. In fact, Alex Googles all the way to Idaho Falls Airport. He knows how to get home from there. While he's doing that, again, we're having the storage unit. What do we know is the Jeep is coming back. It's back in Idaho and around Rexburg around the time of 3:54 and 4:28 when LPR readers note the Jeep back up there. What do both this defendant and Alex Cox do? They're both searching, trying to get the news. Brandon shot? Did he die? Did he live? What happened? Do they have leads? And again, when we talk about the Jeep and this idea that somehow it's not this defendant's Jeep, that she wasn't involved in this, we know that there was gunshot residue, characteristic particles that are unique to just gunshot residue located in the back of this Jeep, not on the seat or the floor, but on the windows. Why? Because when a gun is shot inside of a car, that dust goes everywhere. And that's why they were able to collect that. But do we know that even though this is the defendant's Jeep, Alex Cox's DNA is on it? So let's talk about the jury instructions. I want to go through a few of them in specifics and then talk to you about the charges. Burden of proof. The state has the burden of proof, as we should, and we always will. You're told that the burden of proof is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And you're told that proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you firmly convinced of the defendant's guilt. That there are very few things in this world that we know with absolute certainty, and in criminal cases, the law does not require proof that overcomes every doubt. If, based on your consideration of the evidence, you are firmly convinced that the defendant is guilty of the crime charged, you must find her guilty. When we talk about reasonable doubt and that burden of proof, I want to start with what it isn't. Proof beyond all reasonable doubt is not proof beyond all doubt. It's not proof beyond all possible doubt. It's proof beyond any reasonable doubt. And I'll give an example. When Kyle Mueller was on the stand and he was questioned about gunshot residue, he was asked, for instance, if a bunch of hairspray could cause the GSR in the car. And he said, well, maybe like one of the particles, but not all three. So maybe if all they had found, possibly you could say that was a doubt, but is it a reasonable doubt that hairspray caused the GSR in the car? No. So let's talk about direct and circumstantial evidence. And that's because we have a mixture of both here. So direct evidence is evidence that a witness saw, heard, or otherwise sensed an event. What Brandon told you about that happened that day. What Robert Abutamarku told you about. That's direct evidence. Circumstantial evidence is the proof of a fact or facts from which you may find another fact. And you're told the law makes no difference between direct and circumstantial evidence. So I'm going to give you an example here as well so that we can understand what you can do with circumstantial evidence and why it is so important. Assume you are seated on a beach and it's in a cove and you can see on each side you lose sight of people. While you're sitting there, you're the only person on the beach, there's no footsteps there, and you see a person come from your left, walk in front of you and go to your right. They go around a corner, you lose sight of them. A couple minutes later, someone comes in and says, hey, did you see anyone come by? And you say, yeah, they just went that way. That is direct evidence. You saw it. Now imagine you're on that same beach, same situation. Sand is smooth, you close your eyes for 5 minutes. When you open them, you see footsteps now on the beach. You can see the toes and the heel. So you can see the direction as it crossed again from your left to your right, but you don't see a person at all there. You know, your eyes have been closed for about 5 minutes. Someone comes up and says, hey, has anyone gone by? And you go, yeah, I mean, in the last 5 minutes, someone went that way. That is called circumstantial evidence, and you are able to infer from that that someone went by. So let's talk about the crime. The conspiracy to commit first-degree murder requires that the defendant on or about October 2nd, 2019, with the intent to promote or aid in the commission of first-degree murder, agreed with Alexander Cox that at least one of them or another would engage in conduct that constituted first-degree murder. I'm going to go through a few things, then I'm going to talk about them all together, because these jury instructions really have to be considered as one. So conspiracy. When we're talking about conspiracy, we're talking about the defendant agreeing with Alex Cox and others to engage in that conduct, first-degree murder. That she had to intend to promote or assist, and that's going to be very important here, in the commission of that conduct. She doesn't have to be the shooter, she has to promote or assist it. And that the intended conduct would constitute the crime of first-degree murder. Again, doesn't have to be completed. That's why it's conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. Proof of the membership. You're told that one may become a member of a conspiracy without knowing every detail. She doesn't have to know how long Alex is waiting there, what type of bullets he's going to use. The evidence must show beyond a reasonable doubt that the conspiracy was knowingly formed and that the defendant or other persons participated in the unlawful plan with the intent to promote or assist the carrying out of the conspiracy. In determining whether a conspiracy exists, you should consider the actions and statements of all of the alleged participants. So you're going to have to look at everything and look at what this defendant did to promote or assist that conspiracy. So, first-degree murder. Again, I'm going to just note that conspiracy means the parties agreed to engage in that conduct, so it doesn't mean there has to be a death. They are conspiring to kill someone. So, we know that someone shot at Brandon Boudreaux and came very close to causing his death. They have to intend or knew that he or she would cause the death of another person, which when you are shooting at them with a rifle, that is what you are intending or knowing, and they acted with premeditation. Talk about premeditation and then we'll wrap it all together to discuss. So, premeditation means that they intended to kill another person and that they formed an intent or knowledge and then reflected on it. Now, in Arizona, premeditation does not require some long, drawn-out plan. Reflection can be very fast. But in this case, we have premeditation that is days and weeks before this. We're talking about September 23rd, 24th, 25th, all the way through up to October 2nd. So this premeditation is above and beyond what is required by the law. This defendant started helping when they went to buy that burner phone, when she loaned her Jeep to allow it to be tinted, when she Googled how to remove that rear seat, and they took off the tire, and she kept it with her. Then she rented a storage unit and put it in there. When she kept her brother's cell phone and kept it with her as she went around Idaho, and when she made that call between those two phones right around the time of when the shooting was supposed to occur. That is the aiding and the promoting done by this defendant. That is her acts. That is the conspiracy. But again, you look at all of the evidence to see how does that fit in. It's not just someone holding someone's phone. If that were it, sure. We might wonder what's going on. But you can't look at these facts simple and separate. You have to look at the actions of everyone and see how that fits in with all the evidence in this case. This defendant didn't just go buy a phone at Walmart, and that was that. This defendant didn't just rent a storage unit and put her own personal property in there. This defendant didn't just decide to loan her Jeep to her brother and then decide to take the rear tire off it and the interior seat out of it. She did all of these things to aid and promote this first-degree murder. When we're talking about defenses in this case, there are potential ones we'll talk about. You've heard in this trial that maybe there was no shooting. There's not even a first-degree murder because I believe there were some thoughts about that Brandon's, the hole in his car was made by a tire iron or whatever other defenses there were. But what do we know? Yes, there's a shooting here. Brandon's car has a bullet hole in it. There are fragments from that bullet hole in there. There's damage to his glass consistent with that location of the bullet hole in his car. Brandon called 911 out of breath from the fear of having just been shot when that bullet hit the frame of his car right near his head and shattered that window next to him. The Ring camera and that gunshot that you heard. Robert Abitamarco putting the Jeep there is idling there. So, is that a defense? No. There was a shooting. So what else? All right, we've heard something about Melanie doing it. She had a financial motive. And I'm not here to tell you that Melanie wasn't involved in this. I'm telling you that this defendant was also involved in this. When we talk about a conspiracy to commit murder, there can be multiple people involved in that conspiracy. There were multiple people involved in that conspiracy. Melanie Boudreau was the only one that had the address. So, yes, she was involved. But was she it? No. This defendant helped ensure that her brother could help Melanie by killing off her soon-to-be ex-husband, by loaning him the Jeep, by helping make the Jeep available and accessible to fire out of, removing that rear tire, removing the seat, allowing him to put the dark tint on it, and taking it with him. And then providing that alibi over those days while he was gone to help cover up that he was the shooter. I think she also said maybe she's not responsible for what her brother has done. But we know she is responsible. She is a co-conspirator. She is assisting, she is promoting in this crime. We know from the 25th on, she is helping to get the phone, to get ready, to make the Jeep ready, to cover up for her brother, to hide those extra parts, to Google how to even get the Jeep ready, and eventually also trying to figure out what went wrong so they could then determine what to do after. Brandon Boudreau knew who was involved. He may not have seen who did this. The defendant has tried to explain away the evidence and questioning witnesses, asking if it's possible for a single piece of evidence to mean something other than what everyone knows it means. Is it possible that a Coke bottle broke in the street and one little shard stayed there right where Brandon Boudreau's Tesla was located when it was shot? A shard that looks just like the glass from his car in the driveway, inside the seats? Is it possible that a tire iron made that bullet hole in the Tesla? Is it possible that the GSR in the Jeep is hairspray and fireworks? Is it possible that a Jeep with Texas plates belonged to someone else who wanted to kill Brandon? Is it possible that Alex was in Idaho and called her on October 2nd at 8:02 for those 24 minutes?
Don't fall for the defendant's questions about what is possible when the evidence shows exactly what occurred. The only explanation when we look at all of the evidence together is that this defendant conspired with her brother and others to try to kill Brandon Boudreau. The state asks you to look at all of the evidence, not just the is it possibles, and find the defendant guilty of conspiracy to commit first degree murder. Thank you.
All right, the defense can give its closing argument.
When a family breaks apart, it is a tragedy, with a devastation far-reaching, affecting many people. I am not exempt from tragedy, none of us are. But what we learn from it is most important. Because of this experience, I've studied the law and the judicial system, and that knowledge will stay with me forever. When we experience tragedy, we can grow stronger from the experiences, and then those experiences are not all negative. You would think that often people in my position would feel defensive or angry, and from where I'm standing, I understand that very well. But I don't feel any of those things. You have watched me under pressure, under scrutiny, and even under attack. And I have shown you that I'm not on any of those things.
I'm going to object to character evidence and testimony that's
sustained.
Not in evidence.
Ms. Daybell, could I have you pull that microphone a little closer, please?
You can't be upset with people who are forced to look at your life from a distance or judge it through a lens that's being intentionally distorted or being at least very limited. Like the lens the state has shown you on this event, there's so much more going on that is not included to your view. The law prevents some of these things from being shared.
Can I object, Your Honor, to improper?
Sustained.
You have seen opinions formed by strangers trying to put together a narrative. I have shown you that basically there is no defense to what a person did not do or did not participate in. Other than what you've seen, which is no evidence that I made an agreement to commit a crime, because no such evidence exists. So I'm not defensive, I'm not angry. Nobody has all the pieces to this puzzle. It is complex. Like most families, this is a complex issue. And like the state, I was not there. But there is no agreement, no plan, no gain. I am no stranger to tragedy. The breaking up of a family is tragedy. On June 25th, 2019, Brandon Boudreau decided that I was responsible for his family tragedy. And I'm really sorry that he feels that way.
No, Your Honor, I'm going to object again to testimony.
All right. The jury is reminded that what is said in closing statements or closing arguments is not evidence, it is not testimony. The intent of the closing argument is for each side to argue what the evidence shows. Go ahead.
I did and have supported my niece Melanie when she suffered tragedy as a young child and during this terribly difficult time in 2019. We read the text from Brandon to me on June 25th, 2019, where he claims that he will never stop until he proves that I am responsible. Well, here we are, almost 6 years later, and I'm charged with conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. In order to have a conspiracy, two or more people have to make an agreement to commit a crime. There is no such agreement between me and my brother Alex, although I did love my brother Alex.
And I'm going to object again, Your Honor, to testifying.
Sustained.
There is no agreement that was shown to you between myself and Melanie Boudreau, although I love Melanie.
And I'm going to object again to testifying.
Sustained.
I cannot tell you what happened that day on October 2nd, 2019, because I was not there.
And I'm going to again object to testifying, and please strike everything the defendant has said.
All right. The defendant is admonished you cannot argue things that were not admitted into evidence.
The prosecutor wasn't there. Law enforcement wasn't there. Only Brandon knows what happened before he called 911. Only Brandon said he will not stop. The fact that I supported Melanie in her time of need does not make me against Brandon. I had nothing to gain by Brandon being hurt. Brandon has worked with law enforcement for almost 6 years to make sure that I pay a consequence.
I'm going to object to misstating the evidence.
Stain, the jury will determine what the evidence did and did not show.
Your job is to determine if I committed a crime, this crime, a conspiracy, an agreement, not cleaning out a garage, but an agreement to commit murder. You did not see an agreement. You did not hear an agreement. You heard Detective Duncan say that he had spent hundreds of hours going over my iCloud accounts. They have 19 years of my accounts. Text messages,
and I'm going to object to misstates the evidence and no.
If there was an agreement.
Hold on. The objection sustained. The jury is reminded that they will determine what the evidence did and did not show. Go ahead.
If there was an agreement, they would have showed it to you. There is no agreement. We've all experienced tragedies in our lives, and naturally people want someone to blame, someone to pay a price. My brother is no longer here. We can't ask him about that day. There were things presented in this case that I did not know.
And I'm going to object again to testifying, Your Honor, and ask to strike.
Sustained.
Things that I saw, I thought.
And again, I'm going to already ask to strike.
All right. The defendant cannot testify to things that were not testified to from the witness stand.
Because this is the theory the prosecutor wants you to see, it is limited. How can we say clearly when the law only allows for a skewed view of things? The devastation this family has gone through is the tragedy. After almost 6 years, it's time for healing. Thank you.
State wish to give a rebuttal close?
Thank you.
All right, the state has the burden to prove the defendant guilty, and since they have that burden, they have the right to open and close the argument. Go ahead.
The defendant wants you to think that Brandon has it out for her. She has tried to insinuate that Brandon was involved in with working with Detective Piller for years just to get her. But what you heard was that Brandon has actually been working with law enforcement on multiple investigations. And that, in fact, Melanie Boudreau is a subject of multiple investigations. So again, as the defendant sits up here and tries to portray and paint a picture for you of her innocence and sadness and family tragedy, she again misrepresents what was told to you at trial. She tells you there was no plan, but she ignores the facts and the evidence of a very obvious long plan. A plan that started when she began, this defendant, Lori Vallow, meddling in Melanie and Brandon's marriage. And when that marriage was finally ending, this defendant continued to help her niece, Melanie, She continued to aid her.
And what we see in every one of these bits of evidence is a core group of people. This defendant, her brother Alex, Melanie Boudreau, and Chad Daybell. The four of them working together. Do we need to have words of video? No, we do not. That is why there is that jury instruction on direct and circumstantial evidence. Because you look at what is going on here, and it screams to you a conspiracy by this defendant, by Melanie Boudreau, by Alex Cox, and by Chad Daybell to kill Brandon Boudreau. Every action you see there, the defendant would like you to look at them individually and pretend that they don't all point to what happened on October 2nd. But everything they did leading up to then shows you a way to cover up and prepare for the murder of Brandon Boudreau. When we talk about a plan and this defendant's actions, the most obvious and screaming piece of information is this defendant holding on to her brother's phone for days. Holding on to the 480-351-9120 number for days while her brother is gone with her Jeep, without the rear tire, without the back seat, with a gun with him. That is part of the plan. That is the assisting, that is the promoting, that is the conspiracy that this defendant wants you to pretend doesn't exist. We don't need words. We have actions that are obvious, and they're done by this defendant and her co-conspirators. The state asks you to look at everything together, regardless of how many people want to cry up here. Regardless of how many people want to try to testify, this is not evidence. What is evidence is what was presented to you in trial, and each piece of that tells you this defendant is guilty. And so I ask you to find her guilty of the conspiracy to commit murder against Brandon Boudreau. Thank you.
All right, members of the jury, the case is going to be submitted to you shortly, but first we're going to draw our alternate jurors. Again, we have extra jurors just in case someone becomes sick or is unable to proceed. So we're going to call three alternate jurors. If you are an alternate juror, it may be disappointing to get to this stage in the trial and not be in the deliberation process, but I have in the past had to call back an alternate juror to come back in the jury room when a juror is unable to proceed. So the admonition would still apply to you until we call you and let you know that you're excused. If I don't see you again as far as an alternate, I want to thank you for participating in this process. We couldn't have done it without you. Now we're going to use our very scientific method and draw numbers out of a hat here. Juror three, you're our first alternate. We're going to draw another.
16.
16. Okay, and?
7.
Jurors 3, 7, and 16, 7. Okay. I'll come back and talk to you in a few moments before you go, but please, the admonition still applies. I have had to call alternates back. Again, I thank you for your service in this matter. We're going to swear in my staff, the staff that I have so far. My Jay is on vacation this week, so go ahead.
Do you swear that you will take charge of this jury and protect their deliberations from all outside interference and communication, and when they have reached a verdict, you will bring them back into court without revealing their verdict to anyone to help you, God?
I do.
All right. The jury is excused at this time to begin their deliberations. Thank you. All right, please be seated. The jury is no longer present. I'm going to put everyone on notice that it would be the court's intent to take a verdict within about 20 to 25 minutes of being notified that the jury has a verdict. So if you want to be present for that verdict, I would advise everyone to stay within about 20 minutes of the courthouse, in other words, in the immediate downtown area. The state has filed an allegation of aggravating circumstances back in January of 2024. One of those aggravators is essentially kind of an overlap with a finding of dangerousness. What other aggravators would the state intend on proceeding with if there were a guilty verdict?
Your Honor, we could just prove the dangerous allegation and accomplice. That would be sufficient.
Okay. Last time we discussed this issue, the defendant was requesting a probable cause hearing, but also indicated that she didn't want to have an aggravating factors hearing. So let me ask the defendant, last time you admitted aggravators, I don't know what your intent is on this time around.
I would object to the aggravating Of course, I would object to it. I asked for a 13.5 hearing on it so that those aggravators could have probable cause. If you're going to go forward with them, then I will stipulate to them.
All right. Well, the court, I don't think you're entitled to a probable cause hearing, but based on the evidence that was admitted, the court would find that there's probable cause been established that this was a dangerous offense and that there was the presence of an accomplice. I'll go ahead and prepare the instructions just in case, and then we'll see what the jury does. Please make sure that my assistant has the necessary contact information for everyone. But again, I would ask people to stay within 20 minutes of the courthouse. All right, thank you.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.